Você está ouvindo Café Debug.
Muito bom dia, boa tarde, boa noite. Sejam muito bem-vindos ao Café Debug, o seu podcast de tecnologia para não bugar sua cabeça. Meu nome é Jéssica Natani, comigo com o host Wesley Fratini.
Fala galera, tudo beleza?
Se você está escutando esse programa, não esqueça de compartilhar. Estamos em todas as redes sociais, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram também. Então, dúvidas, sugestões, pode mandar um e-mail pra gente, uma mensagem no debugcafe@gmail.com. E hoje nós temos um programa diferente, com um convidado internacional. Então, nós faremos uma entrevista em inglês com o Dejan. Para quem não sabe, o Dejan já fez umas participações com a gente. E, ao mesmo tempo, eu vou explicar em português alguns pontos da conversa para vocês conseguirem entender. Welcome to Dejan for our podcast. So, hello everyone, welcome to the podcast Café Debug, your science and technology podcast. My name is Jéssica Natani, and I am your host, and with me, Wesley Fratini, your co-host.
Hello everyone, how are you?
Today's show, we are going to talk about the scalability advantages for scalability, architecture, DevOps. And with us, again, Dejan Mili. How is it going, Dejan?
Hello, Jéssica and Wesley. Thank you for having me again. I'm doing very well, thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Dejan is a software craftsman at the RavenDB, DevRel, and sharing knowledge with us about the technology, concepts, technologies. When we discussed here, we talked about the scalability, DevOps, revolution, and the same concepts about the software architecture. So, nesse caso, a gente vai discutir aqui um pouco sobre escalabilidade, DevOps, alguns conceitos sobre arquitetura, né? Então, vou pedir para o Dejan se apresentar, para quem ainda não conhece, né? Dejan, can you introduce yourself for our listeners, please?
Sure. I'm mathematician by education. I was working for a number of years as a software developer. And then, you know, for most of software developers, it's either that you continue working as a coder for a number of years or decades, or you switch into management. Well, this would be some kind of third option. I became DevRel person for RavenDB. So what do I do in my daily life in the office? I still do write code. I talk to people who are coding and making software projects, but I don't have these typical straight deadlines. So what I'm doing, I'm creating education, I'm creating demo projects, and I'm helping people who are using RavenDB to use it in most optimal way.
Great, let's to explain in Portuguese for our listeners. Dejan falou que trabalha com DevRel, trabalha também, faz parte da equipe do RavenDB. Compartilha conhecimento também, ajuda outras pessoas na parte de código, gosta de codificar. E ele entende bastante sobre arquitetura e essas coisas que a gente vai discutir e alguns pontos do RavenDB. Dejan, let's to start here about some concepts DevOps. So, let's to start principle, fundamentos of software architecture. Eu vou fazer algumas perguntas para ele sobre alguns conceitos de arquitetura e alguns pontos principais que precisamos manter atenção. Fundamentals of software architecture. Dejan, sometimes the people confusing when creating your architecture mix for your architecture, and sometimes we create a lot of layers or architecture of layers, but using DTOs the same ROM, or using example exposed our domain for a controller example, and we don't have a concept used correctly. In your opinion, what is the fundamentals we need to do, to think, to learn about the architecture for to start? For example, for a monolithic application, the basic application, think the simple thing. What do you do? What do you think?
Sure. So when you look at what actually software architecture is, when you start reading books, you will see there is no strict definition. But in some sense, when you look at your project, those parts which are hard to change are essentially your software architecture. So whenever you think about all these underlying things, so your code will be doing some kind of functionality, some calculations. If you're building business application, you already can understand what is business functionality of your application. Well, all these underlying parts of your application that are helping your code execute and maybe scale and operate correctly are essentially software architecture. So the characteristics of software architecture is it is hard to change, in the sense that if you start changing architecture, these changes will propagate all the way around your application. So if you imagine something that is a simple change, let's say you need to introduce ability to add many users or many tenants, simple one sentence requirements like that, if you start changing your architecture to implement them, you will see that these changes can turn out to be very, very demanding. And for this reason, a good software architect is a person who will attempt to postpone all these major decisions as long as he or she can. Because these are big decisions, they are long lasting. Imagine simple thing like running in the cloud. So you build application and you made decision to go with something like AWS. And now think about, okay, you're running on AWS, you're having a startup, and all of a sudden, here is GCP, Google Cloud Platform, offering you free credits. Now think about how easy or hard would it be for you to accept, let's say, $100,000 in free GCP credits from Google, and transfer your application from AWS onto GCP. If you used your knowledge wisely, if you made wise decisions, and if you, for example, do not have any kind of vendor lock-in, this will be easy for you. But if your software architecture was relying on the services of AWS, it doesn't matter that you got $100,000, you simply cannot use them, because you would have to rewrite the good parts of your application. So software architecture is something very important, but at the same time, people, my experience, and I was also overcomplicating at certain phases during my career. So I would say software architecture is something that you need, but every piece of your software architecture, it's like a marriage. You have relationship with something, some piece of technology, framework, cloud provider, and this is long-lasting. You picked up certain piece of technology or structure of your application. You mentioned, Jessica, something like MVC, maybe controllers. So now this is the structure that you will have to carry on for a long, long time, because, you know, architectural changes are hard, and you also must think about business aspects. Businesses need to live. Businesses need to produce new things every week, every month. People are demanding new things from you. So from the perspective of the business owner, changing pieces of architecture is hard, because this means that, let's say, for next 2 months, you're going to rework, refactor your architecture. So over the course of next 2 months, there will not be single piece of business value coming out of your team. And you can already imagine how painful this can be.
Vou pedir para o Neja explicar um pouquinho mais sobre autodisponibilidade no sistema, então explicando o conceito ali de disponibilidade e algumas estratégias usadas. Hey Neja, can you explain a little about high availability in the system, explaining of the concept of availability and strategies?
Absolutely. So, first, what is high availability? Availability is percentage of the time that your service or application is up and running, simply speaking, available. Availability is usually expressed as percentage. So some numbers that people are operating with would be 99% or 99.9%. There is no system that has 100% of availability time. So usually you will strive to achieve something like 99.99, that would be so-called four nines. Or if you go with five nines, that would be 99.999%. And even if you have five nines, which is very high standard, this means that, for example, in 1 year, you will have something like 8.5 minutes of your application not being available to your users. And if you're building a small hobby project, it's not an issue. It's not a problem. But imagine serious e-commerce website, which is making sales every second. This company could literally make a calculation that says every minute that we are not available, we will lose this amount of money. So it could be something like $10,000 per minute or maybe $100,000 per minute. You can think about, for example, Amazon, how many customers Amazon has checking out every minute. So for obvious reasons, businesses want to have high availability, as much uptime as possible. Because every second, every minute that you spend being unavailable will cost you money. And there are various strategies how to do it. If you think about old movies, you will see very big boxes. Computers were multi-ton heavy and meters wide. Well, this is because miniaturization emerged later on. But what you also have is these mainframe computers, which have first idea of high availability implemented, and this would be redundant. So if you think about hardware server that your application is running on, many things that can go wrong with this machine. Motherboard can die, hard drive can go out, power supply can go out. So first idea by people who were building high available system was to create a machine that has redundant components. So, for example, mainframe computers have high level of redundancy. This means that you have two power supplies. If one of them goes down, the second one will step in. And all the components are duplicated, maybe sometimes even triplicated. So this was first idea. Of course, you can imagine that such machines are very expensive. This is specialized hardware. So it's not that everyone can afford it. Imagine some kind of small startup. Budget is always a problem. So in the 90s, a different philosophy was developed, and Google was in the forefront of this approach, where you don't have these super expensive machines with high redundant components. Instead, what Google went with were ordinary machines, like machines we are using at home. And Google set up a cluster of these machines, and these machines are working together. And you expect that some of them will go down, but then you have a cluster of many machines that can replace one another. And if you have work to do, you will distribute, you will parallelize this work into chunks, you will send them to several machines. So essentially what I just described are concepts of vertical and horizontal scalability. So vertical scalability would be simply speaking making a piece of hardware which is very powerful and redundant. And when it comes to horizontal scalability, and this also touches concept of scalability that we will touch a bit later on, with horizontal scalability, you establish cluster of many machines which are working together, you spread your load over several machines, and that way you increase capability. In both of these cases, you have high availability to some extent, because if you have single machine with redundant components, then you know if any of the components are broken, you have replacement in this machine. If you're going with a cluster of many individual small machines, then you can simply count on these machines replacing one another, providing work, so you will be sending loads of work to different machines. If they do not respond, it's not a problem. You have some kind of coordinator which will attempt to process same amount of data on another machine. And this concept is applied, for example, with web servers, with web farm. So typical architecture in that case for high availability would be that you have a load balancer, and behind load balancer, you have so-called farm of servers. And requests for the website or web application are arriving at the load balancer, and then load balancer will distribute these requests equally to one all of these machines behind which are in so-called web farm. So that would be some basic common sense approaches to high availability.
Você está ouvindo Café Debug.
Good. O DJ explicou aqui sobre as diferenças entre escalabilidade vertical, horizontal, e como isso pode impactar na questão de custos também com a cloud, AWS e esses pontos. Temos também uma discussão, uns pontos que ele falou sobre o poder computacional que a máquina precisa, a diferença entre você adicionar recursos computacionais e, em alguns casos, utilizados mais como e-commerce, quando você precisa de um tempo de resposta muito alto, e alguns pontos arquiteturais também. Agora eu vou perguntar para o Dejan, é uma experiência que eu tive com relação a storage procedures no banco e como isso pode impactar a performance também da aplicação. Dejan, I have worked in some projects that I needed to improve performance exactly in the database. Sometimes I feel like a DBA, but it's a thing to do in the database. We can impact a lot of things, the performance in your application. Example, storage procedures with joins or like, né? In this case, SQL database. Né? In your vision, your experience, do you need to do improve the scalability or performance in your application exactly in database in your life, in your experience?
Yes, so I have been developer for a number of years, and I was using both SQL relational databases and NoSQL ones. And when you look at historical inception, relational databases, SQL ones came first. And initially, they were developed in early 80s, meaning that they were working on these mainframe computers I already mentioned. SQL databases are not natively supporting horizontal scalability. They're not natively supporting cluster setups. So usually in a typical application setup that you will observe with the SQL database, this means that you will have, for example, load balancer. Behind load balancer, you have several web servers, and all of these web servers are hitting single database. And you can already feel the moment I said single database hit by multiple servers, you can already feel where actual problem lies. Several web servers hitting one single database. It's not only problem of capacity, it is also problem of the nature that relational databases are operating. So in every single database, it doesn't matter if it's SQL or NoSQL, you have some data stored. You will be executing queries on such data that you stored because you want to filter data, you want to sort data, and you want to compute aggregations. So what is the mechanism to speeding up queries? Because imagine you are Walmart, you have 1 million employees, and you say, okay, give me everyone who is here for more than 5 years. Well, if your database needs to operate on raw data, this means that your database needs to go and read every single employee from any of these tables, inspect them to come up with results for you. Of course, this is untenable because working with raw data is very, very demanding on the machine. So people came up with several mechanisms to overcome this. Most famous one would be concept of the index. So index is inverted data structure. Most famous example of index in real life is something that younger people never saw in their lives, but I saw it. It's a phone book where everyone living in a certain city are sorted by the last name. So when you want to find someone, you have an easy time locating this person in the phone book. So indexes are main speed up factor. Indexes are pre-computed inverted data structures that provide way for database engine to easily, effortlessly find data in these tables. Unfortunately, with relational databases, you have, let's call it strong ACID approach, where you have so-called transactional index updates. So what you will do, you will, in order to speed up your queries, you will introduce indexes. Now, these indexes will be used to serve queries. And in relational databases, whenever you write new data to any of these tables, within the same transaction, indexes will be updated. So this means when you're writing to your data to a database, you have to wait for indexes to be updated. And only after indexes are updated, your write transaction will be over. What is interesting is while indexes are being updated, they are locked. They cannot be used because they are being updated. So what this means is following thing. You are writing to a database. This will lock indexes for a short period of time. Any query that arrives to the database from other users, queries arriving from other users that want to use this very same index will not be able to use it because the index is locked at this very moment. So these queries will be queued. So what this means is a bit of paradox, because what you did, you introduced lots of indexes to serve your queries, but the more indexes you have, when you are writing to the database, all of them will have to be updated, which means that your writes will be slower and slower the more indexes you have. And at the same time, if you do heavy writing to the database, queries arriving to relational database will be queued. They will be waiting in line for indexes to be unlocked. And then they will be served once index update is over. Then they will be taken from the queue and executed. So in some sense, you have this dichotomy or this paradox where you want to have lots of indexes to speed up your queries, but at the same time, this will affect your writes. And this was especially detected in the era of the internet. And this is how NoSQL databases were born. So with most of the NoSQL databases, you have different way to model data, so you are not splitting your objects into multiple tables anymore. You can store one object in a document NoSQL database as a single JSON document, which means that when you are fetching such object, you don't have to reassemble it. This is first good consequence of different way of modeling data. You can still execute joins, but these joins are now representing actual natural relationship between the data. So if you want to pull out all orders from your database, orders contain order lines because JSON can contain collections. You don't need to access tables like orders, order lines, shipping addresses. That would be, for example, three tables. You access just one document. So by the very definition of the storage format, you have much more efficient operations. And overall, when you look at NoSQL databases, they try to solve some inherent shortcomings of SQL databases.
Exactly, this is my question. I'll let it explain here for our listeners. O DJ falou que trabalhou com tempo com esses problemas do database, né, SQL, e ele tocou num ponto exatamente que eu queria, que era com relação a gente discutiu, ele explicou que o banco SQL, o SQL, ele é, claro, menos performático que um NoSQL. A gente sabe que o NoSQL é muito mais rápido. Então, o que que traz essa como que eu posso dizer, não ganho de performance que o SQL traz com relação aos index nas tabelas, os joins, isso perde um pouco a performance, deixa um pouco mais lento e afeta a aplicação como um todo. Agora eu vou explicar para o Dejan a mesma situação que eu estive trabalhando essa semana, e é um ponto que é que ele acabou de mencionar sobre o index, né? Se você não tiver uma tabela bem indexada, essas coisas. It's a good point, Dejan. What I could see working proven this procedure, I have gains and lose. On the one hand, you can gain performance. On the other, you can gain decrease in memory. Mm-hmm. When you told about the index, when you have an index in the table is not used, maybe we can increase decrease in this case memory or I/O the database. And doesn't matter you have a great application, cloud, many machines works together, but your database not have a works better with an index or have a lot of joins in the database. But we need to discuss here because we have many companies works with software, legacy software, and needed to use and business rules in storage procedures, in this case to do migration for a new application. It's very hard and difficult at the moment because we have a cost, no? But you discuss it's the point, a great point about the indexes table.
Yes, I also have been working on such projects where database represents a bottleneck, and I also have been working as a consultant with some other companies. And what you can see in practice is that, for example, if you have a business intelligence department, let's say, and they are running some kind of aggregations for reporting, believe it or not, running aggregations on a database can affect, to create reports, it can affect actual performance of the production systems. So I saw the cases of a business intelligence department being forbidden to run reporting during business hours. And when you think about it conceptually, it's a bit ridiculous because database should be this reliable and powerful engine that is able to run queries and produce results. This is what we created databases for. So usual solution in such organizations is to create something called read replica. So you have main production database, your application writes to. You have read replica, which means another server with the same database, which will be updated by the main application database. And then if you want to create in such organization any kind of reports with aggregations, then these reports will be created from read-only replica. So you can already think about how this works in everyday life. Your database becomes your bottleneck. And this is not a pleasant situation. And there's one more story when it comes to databases overall, and this is concurrency. And with web applications, all of us, we are facing concurrency issues. And what do I mean by that? Let's say I have some kind of document or object which is shared between several users. So if you allow two users to load the same document on the screen, make edits, and save it back to the database, you just run into concurrency issue because both of them could be changing document at the same time, and both of them could be saving it back into the database. Or if you think about something like a bank, you could have several credit cards or several debit cards connected to the same account. And imagine three members of the household paying at the same time, or you have all these subscriptions like Netflix or Spotify or Apple taking money once per month from your account. So when it comes, for example, to the example of the bank, this is money and you need to take this more seriously. So how you provide concurrency in such cases, do you go with locking? There are basically two strategies for battling concurrency in the databases. One of them is locking. What do I mean by locking? This means, okay, I want to make transaction from of money, transferring money from account A to account B. So how my code will look like? I will start database transaction. I will read the amount of money from account A. I will deduct amount of money that I want to transfer, and I will save state on the account A. But what do I need to be completely sure of is that during this code execution that I just described, there will not be changes in the database on the amount of money that account A has. Because if I have $100 on account A, maybe there will be $50 by the time I'm attempting to save my transaction. So I can either go and lock database row with the state of the account. That would be one solution. But then this means if I locked the state of the account, this means that other concurrent users are lined. So I'm introducing some kind of the block in the code execution of my application. Another solution would be something called optimistic concurrency. So you have what you have in such scenario is some kind of a timestamp or unique GUID or any other mechanism, which is fingerprint of the current state. So what I will do, I will read the data from the database and I will got this optimistic concurrency tag. I will change the data and I will send my data to be saved into the database, along with this tag that I originally read for GUID, for example, or a timestamp of last update of the row. And then within the database, there is a mechanism that will compare the timestamp of my original read with the current timestamp. And this mechanism is used to determine if there were any changes in the database since the time I originally read the data. So these are very serious problems because you are actually having competition by multiple users to use database at the same time. And if you're not careful, you may end up with introducing locks or cross locks where you have two processes in the memory accessing same resources or share resources, and they are waiting for each other to release the lock. So if you have for example, a legacy project where you have queries or write operations which you have to wait for, let's say, 5 seconds, which is eternity for code, for very fast machines we have today, it is high probability that the database is the bottleneck and you actually have congestion on the level of the database.
Você está ouvindo Café Debug.
Perfect. Dejan explicou aqui as questões também, um ponto importante sobre a concorrência na parte do banco de dados. Deu alguns exemplos de, imagina se fossem algumas big techs como Apple ou outras empresas que tivessem problema de concorrência. E deu uma pincelada também, um ponto sobre unique timestamp, para identificar também essas competições e os problemas que podem ocorrer com essas concorrências, como bloqueio de memória, blocos em tabelas. E agora eu vou perguntar para a Dejan a respeito, já continuando esse assunto sobre concorrência, e a questão entre se o banco de dados NoSQL, ele pode ajudar a resolver para projetos legados a essa questão de concorrência, ou a gente teria que ter uma abordagem como mensageria, eventos. So Dejan, I think here in your answer about concurrence, in database. And what do you think to solve concurrence and application, some problems, in legacy projects, a legal approach would be to use NoSQL database to work separately or use events or events architecture for solve these problems, the concurrence.
Mm-hmm. So when you look at the essence, what database is persistence mechanism, because our applications are creating objects and data structures in the memory. And now imagine turning off, killing your application or turning off the server, you will lose everything from the memory. So the very reason we introduced databases is to have long-term persistence of the data we create in the memory. That is what databases are for. However, as it is the case with other things in life, if you start using some tools for the other purposes than they were originally developed for, you may run into problems. So what we are discussing here is problem of concurrency, multiple users trying to access same resources. And you will see that lots of teams are using database as a solution, as a synchronization mechanism to solving concurrency problem. And obviously, you can already see where I'm going to, because databases were not meant to be this mechanism for solving concurrency problems. And now when you look at what could be a better solution to solve such problems, for example, you will see something like a queue. If you have multiple users trying to do some things on your system, you can simply create a queue. You can put their requests in the queue and you can process one by one such request. And you can have multiple queues, so to make sure that requests in these separate queues are not accessing the same resources. What this means then is that you can have worker processes, which are processing requests from these queues. And essentially what you managed to do, you parallelize work in your system without introducing competition for resources. Well, this could be one of the mechanisms for solving concurrency problems. At the same time, you have a problem of scalability. Let's say you have a small number of users, and all of a sudden, you go to very popular podcast like this one and you tell people about, okay, I have this service. Or you appear in the Hacker News. And all of a sudden you have thousands and thousands of people registering for your service. So all of a sudden you have this challenge, okay, now I'm scaling from 150 users to 15,000 users. So this is the moment where you will see how good or bad your choice of the architecture is. Most common solution for such problems is queue, because queue is this mechanism where you are able to accept all these requests and then you will process them. So for example, you had 150 users, you implemented the queue, and you have one machine processing this queue request. Now you know you are becoming popular. This single machine is not enough anymore. So what you can do? Well, you still have this queue. Queue is able to accept hundreds or maybe thousands of these requests, but you need more workers to process this pressure in the queue that you have. So what you may introduce instead of this single machine, you may go and spin up something like Kubernetes cluster. And then Kubernetes cluster can have these rules. If you have, for example, more than 100 requests in the queue, spin up one more pod. Now you will have two pods, two virtual machines in your Kubernetes cluster processing messages, requests in the queue. When you go below, for example, 20 messages in the queue, you have internal rule rule that you can shut down one of these pods. So now you are back to one, let's call it machine, virtual machine, which is taking requests from the queue and processing it. So what I just described is a rather simple mechanism of a queue, which is used to accept requests. You will not reject any of the requests which are coming to your application. And then you have dynamic scalability supported by the Kubernetes, which is scale up and down depending on the pressure on your application. And this is very interesting because you will not have to provision, let's say, dozens of servers, pay for them each month. You will have dynamically scalable architecture, which can answer to the challenges of the traffic. So you may be sleeping in the night, and all of a sudden your application is showcased on Hacker News. But what you have in place is a mechanism that can elastically scale according to the traffic that is arriving to the application. So you can sleep safely without any worries, because you know that the architecture that you set up in the place will elastically scale to accept these thousands and thousands of newly created requests. And at the end of the month, your bill will not be high because you were spinning up capacity dynamically to handle this increased load. But then after load went away, let's say it was Black Friday, you don't have Black Friday is now over, it's Tuesday, your Kubernetes cluster will dynamically scale down. And at the end of the month, you will get a bill just for the capacity that you actually use.
Great. Eu tinha feito uma pergunta para o Dejan sobre a questão de NoSQL resolver problemas de concorrência, né? E ele explicou que não é o objetivo do NoSQL resolver problema de concorrência, né? Então, ele deu até alguns exemplos de filas também, mensageria. E eu quero fazer uma pergunta para ele, a questão sobre mensageria. Eu não sei se o Wesley está com alguma pergunta agora. Eu posso fazer, Wesley?
Pode, pode sim.
A minha ideia é que falar sobre o episódio anterior que fizemos sobre a questão de mensageria. E no ponto de vista dele, a gente sabe que a utilização de filas, uma arquitetura orientada a eventos, resolve alguns problemas, mas podem criar outros. Eu quero saber da opinião dele qual que seria o melhor cenário para aplicar a mensageria, o conceito de mensageria na aplicação. Dejan, we recorded an episode about event driving in architecture. And we often think that serves like a messaging would solve a lot of problems, but using message in a project requires a lot of attention. In your opinion, when we talk about QI, what would be the best scenario to apply? Because we needed to know to apply a driving event in architecture, it's a lot to attention, and we needed to a cost. Sorry. So, in your opinion, what is the best scenario to apply this?
Okay. So. I also went over several architecture style over the years. When you look at typical application using relational database and the typical screens, which are essentially CRUD, so you create data, you read data, you update it, you can see that your application in such architecture is concentrated on a state of the data. So what you're doing, you will save the state of the data to a relational database, for example. You will read it, you will change it, and this change is so-called mutation. That is one approach. Second approach is what you just mentioned, event-driven architecture. And when you look at the nature of such architecture, you will see that you are not mentally concentrated on state anymore. Now you're concentrated on the events and the process. So when you are starting a project, you need to create software for some kind of the enterprise or organization, for example. You pay them a visit, and then you observe what is going on, and what you notice are processes. And then you realize, okay, this is what I need to model, these processes. So you start to take notes of the processes that you can observe. You speak to people and you see that people are communicating in a business organization between each other. And they are handing over some documents or some pieces of information and some things are happening. And then there is interesting modeling approach called event storming. Event storming is actually taking big piece of paper, detecting all these events, grouping them together, and detecting also commands which are producing events. So this approach will help you detect processes going on in the organization, understanding which events will happen in an organization like that, and also understand who is creating these events. So with such analysis, and this is usually called discovery phase of the project, you will actually get knowledge of the organization and the processes you need to implement. Because what people will tell you, they will not tell you, I need to save my invoice into the database. No, they will tell you, I want to create an invoice. So you see, when you start analyzing language, you will see that they are using verbs and they are describing processes and the outcomes. So after you do this discovery phase with something like event storming, and there's lots of talks on the YouTube about event storming for people who are not familiar with this, you will get set of events, you will be able to see the processes. And then you can naturally take these detected events and start implementing them as part of your architecture. And then it's your choice what you want to do with these events. So you may end up using these events to mutate the state in the database, for example. Or you may go one step further and start doing something called event sourcing. So the discovery technique was event storming, where everyone from the organization grouped together in front of big paper to try to identify all the events. And then when you implement these events, there's something called event sourcing. In event sourcing, what you will do, you will not mutate the state of your system. You will simply record events which are happening. Now, what is interesting is that when we are speaking of the events, they represent things that already happened in the past. So events are facts that happened in the past. One such event could be, I created invoice. This is the fact, I created it. And what we will do, we will save in the system precisely this event. Or for example, if you're modeling a bank, there was this amount of money that arrived to my account. This is the fact. So I will not increase the state of my account and save new amount of money in my account. No, what I will save into the database, I will save this event as a fact that happened. And you have specialized databases for that. You can use ordinary databases or you can use specialized ones. Then what you end up with is collection of the facts that happened in such system. And this is nice because now you are building business logic which will interpret these events and compute the current state of the system. So actually, I have been talking about the banks and money transfer from account to account. What actually happens in bank is not keeping current state of your account. No, bank is keeping events which are changing amount of money that you have in your account. So when you go to the bank and say, can you please tell me how much money I have in my account? What software will do? It will take all the events from the beginning of the year. It will play them one by one. And after all of them are applied, bank will have current state of your account. And few good things here is that you are not losing any information. So for example, Imagine big marketing agency. And big marketing agency is running some ads. You know. And then we are collecting information about the effectiveness of these ads. And we may record number of visits to the website every day because that was original request. When we run campaign, we want to record how many people from this campaign arrive every day to the website. And you implement that. And after 2 months, they come back to you and say, okay, now we would like to see statistics. If we play ads during the halftime of the football match, how many users will arrive to the website in 10 minutes after this ad was played? And now you're in a problem because what you were recording originally, it was change of the state. But if you were recording in your persistent a persistence mechanism, like a database, if you were recording events, an event can be, here is new visitor to my website, then you will be able to go back and simply implement new aggregation, new computation that will take these events and seek for different things. So when you are storing events in the database, you are actually not throwing a single piece of information away. So whatever business request comes to you later on, you will be able to compute it based on the facts that happened, and these facts were stored inside of your database. What is also interesting is that event source systems are usually implemented using architectural pattern called CQRS. In such pattern, you will be writing events to one database. And since you are just storing events, you are not mutating anything, you don't have any concurrency problems because this is append-only storage. As events are happening in your application, you will simply send them to be saved to the database. This is so-called in CQRS. CQRS is command query responsibility segregation. In such system, commands are producing events. Events are stored in one database. And then to read the state of the system, to show it on the screen, for example, you have another database where state will be computed based on the events from the first database. So what you end up with is that you have highly efficient writing of events to one database without any concurrency problems, and your queries are hitting second database, which contains the current state of the system. So that way you are solving lots of problems. You have a pad-only storage of the events, and you have your queries hitting another second database, which means that both of these pieces of your system can be using different databases. Query side can be using some fast caching layers, for example. You can optimize them separately. They are totally segregated between them. That's where CQRS, S is segregation. So this would be one of possible approaches to produce highly performant scalable systems.
Great explanation, and thank you about the CQRS in the architecture. I think here, I have, just to finish a point, we can use events. Events are not a way to solve problems of process the past, request a past, or in other time, but we can have an event to use and update a cache data in the database example. You can use the query and the events for this case to update some data in the database cache for use in the other time too.
Correct. When you think about, let's say, a legacy application, and imagine this application is being slow. So what you have your application doing reads and writes to the database. So what could be one of solutions, quick and easy solutions, because you know changes are expensive, and people are very expensive. And if you put three developers to optimize your queries, this means that these three developers are optimizing queries, cannot work on business value. And what our users are expecting from us is a business value. And when you look at the refactoring of the code or optimization, this is not the business value. So your team just got smaller because some members of your team need to do optimizations. So what could be cheapest solution in such scenario? It could be simply paying for more powerful server where database is running. And it turns out that sometimes like a simple act of paying money every month for more memory and faster disk could be cheapest solution. But for example, let's imagine your team decides to use something like a Redis server. So you will be writing to a relational database. Cache will be computed and stored inside of the Redis. And now your queries, your read requests are getting data from Redis. So you see, you just introduced CQRS infrastructure without even thinking about it. You see how you are naturally converging to this architectural pattern, because you are still writing to your relational database, but now lots of your queries, lots of your read requests are not hitting directly your relational database anymore. Now they are hitting Redis. So now you just split it into relational database plus Redis caching server.
Thanks. So, Dejan, our program is over. And thank you very much to join us. It's always an honor to record with you. And do you have anything to share about the RavenDB? We know the RavenDB database and NoSQL. It's a great database. We share knowledge here and we recorded with Orin too. But do you have some topics, some notification for RavenDB?
Yes, so usually people, when people are speaking about big systems, they usually come with a notion of big data. And most people are actually not aware what big data means. So usually today, big data means data that cannot be stored on one machine. Or amount of data where it's more expensive to analyze and delete old obsolete data than to keep. So what we are trying to do with RavenDB, we are trying to make things simple. So first thing, we are supporting now in version 6, we are supporting sharding. So sharded databases are databases which are so big that they cannot fit on a single machine anymore. RavenDB can support on a single machine databases up to 10 terabytes. So now with sharding that we introduced in version 6, RavenDB can support almost unlimited size of the database because sharding is the process of splitting one enormously large database into smaller pieces and putting these pieces on separate machines. Sharding mechanism in a database like RavenDB will make this completely transparent to you. So you as a developer can continue to write same code and database engine will distribute shards of your database across multiple machines. But from your perspective, you still see this as one big piece of data, just as a single database. You don't know how shards are implemented. And this is most important thing. If you imagine a large organization, and by the way, most databases that you will see in production are less than 1 terabyte. I would dare to say that 80% or even more percent of databases, production databases, are 1 terabyte or less. But if we think about large organization with database so big that it is growing every month, growing, at one point in time, amount of data in this database will go over capacity of a single machine. So at this point in time, development team is faced with serious problem, with serious challenge, how to overcome this limitation of a single machine. What we attempted to do with RavenDB is to introduce sharding, which is completely transparent. And what this means is that when you transition from a database hosted on a single machine to shard the database hosted on several machines, you will not have to change a single line in your code. This simply means spinning up several servers, creating new sharded database, importing data from the old one, and you're done. This is the whole idea. From your perspective, database should be engine, which is reliable and predictable, and in ideal case, you will not notice your database. What you want to do, you don't want to spend your time with the database. You want to spend your time on your business, on your project, actually developing business value for your customers.
Good observation, RibbonDB. And to remember, in the episode description here, we have links to RibbonDB documentation and the link, the YouTube link to the Jean Lives podcast about Docker resides, AI, and machine learning we use in RibbonDB. So thank you, Dejan, for joining us. I'm happy for to talk to you, and you have a time for sharing knowledge with us, sharing about the RibbonDB, how is this database works, how this database help people, help organizations. Thanks so much for talking with Café Debug again.
Thank you very much for having me again. It's always a pleasure. It's very pleasant to talk to you about technology.
Thank you. See you. Bye-bye, guys.
Este programa foi editado por Café Debug.